I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. Spirituality, faith, and healing are the subjects of this series of the Holistic Health Show. Dr. Bernie Siegel and Dr. Harold Koenig were selected for the opening of this series, but because of the length of the interviews, they will be scheduled separately for this and the next show. On this show, Dr. Bernie Siegel and Leslie Davenport will be interviewed. Dr. Bernie Siegel, who prefers to be called Bernie, is known internationally and consequently needs no introduction to many throughout the world whose lives have been touched by him. In 1979, he began to talk about patient empowerment and the choice to live fully and die in peace. As a physician who has cared for and counseled innumerable people whose mortality had been threatened by an illness, Bernie embraces a philosophy of living and dying that stands at the forefront of the medical ethics and spiritual issues our society grapples with today. He continues to assist in the breaking of new ground in the field of healing and personality, struggling to live the message of kindness and hope. Bernie attended Colgate University and Cornell University Medical College and holds membership in two Scholastic Honor Societies, Phi Beta Kappa and Alpha Omega Alpha, and graduated with honors. His surgical training took place at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He retired from practice as an assistant clinical professor of surgery at Yale of General and Pediatric Surgery in 1980 to speak with patients and their caregivers. In 1979, he originated Exceptional Cancer Patients, a specific form of individual and group therapy using patient drawings, dreams, images, and feelings. The physical, spiritual, and psychological benefits that followed led him to desire to make everyone aware of his or her healing potential. In 1986, his first book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, was published, and this redirected his life. 1989, Peace, Love, and Healing, and in 1993, How to Live Between Office Visits followed. In 1998, Prescriptions for Living was published, and in 2003, Help Me to Heal, and 365 Prescriptions for the Soul followed. In 2004, Smudge Bunny, and in 2005, 101 Exercises for the Soul, and 2006, Love Magic and Mud Pies followed. His latest book, Love Whole and Healing, was published in 2009. More information is available at www.BernieSiegelMD.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Bernie, and I look forward to hearing about healing, faith, and spirituality. Now first, can you tell us how you got interested in mind-body medicine?
It goes back to attending a lecture, a weekend workshop that Carl Simonton was doing back about 1977 or 8. And because of the title, it seemed to me it was for doctors. You know, it was about cancer and cancer patients. And I was feeling a lot of pain over all the things I couldn't cure and fix. So I thought, hey, if there's more I can do, I'll go. The shock was that of approximately 125 people attending, there were 122 patients, two psychotherapists and myself. And that really blew my mind that all these physicians who are caring for cancer patients, nobody shows up. But sitting with your patients was the education, see? And the basic line, which literally was said to me, was, I need to know how to live between office visits. So I went back to the office, now feeling empowered in the sense that what I had to offer people could go beyond the mechanical aspect, you know, treatment and surgery and so forth, and I could help them to live. And I was amazed at how few people were interested in living, meaning I sent 100 letters to people with cancer from our office. I mean, again, they're getting it from their doctor, you know, not from a stranger, saying, you want to live a longer, better life, come on to a meeting. And I panicked when I realized I forgot to put in this is only for those who receive this letter, because I thought everybody would bring their friends and relatives. So I'm sitting there a nervous wreck wondering what am I going to do with 300 to 500 people, and less than a dozen women showed up. And that's been true over the years, too. It's hard as hell to get the men to come in and deal with emotions, faith, feelings. But what I learned was, to make a long story short, that when you help people live, they didn't die when they were supposed to. You see, and what wasn't scientific is today. I mean, people would yell at me, you haven't done any research. You know, you go to the American Cancer Society, you go to National Institutes of Health, you say, I want to show the benefits of a support group. That's nuts. Why would people live longer? So nobody would support my research, and therefore I got criticized for not doing it. And interesting, I may add, there was a Yale graduate student who said, well, I'll do it as my, you know, like my master's, my thesis. I said, fine, because he said, that won't cost anybody anything. And he came up with statistics that were amazing, that, in other words, the people with women with breast cancer in our support group had a much better survival statistic than a control group he selected. His professor said, that can't be true. Go change the control group. So he altered the control group so that everything came out even. And see, again, then I get criticized. See, it doesn't matter. But, you know, what it was like, our group was called Exceptional Cancer Patients. It's like you go and pick a group of exceptional people and compare them to another group of exceptional people. Sure, they come out the same. But when you pick them in a random way, not about how long they've already lived, then it showed a significant difference. And see, today, well, a recent study that came out, you have, you know, your doctor says you don't have long to live. And you choose aggressive chemotherapy versus palliative care. Let me go home and just be comfortable and enjoy myself. And what did the study show? Those who went for palliative care lived longer than those who had the aggressive therapy. And that's basically, again, what I saw. You know, you help people live, not just have conflict, what I call waging a war. When you wage a war against your disease, you empower your enemy. But when you heal your life, then a lot of nice things happen. And these are the things that you see are now becoming scientific. And actually, the way I used to judge a good hospice, and still would, I'd go in and say, do you have any dropouts? And they'd say, what do you mean? I said, you have people who come here to die and then change their mind and go home. And the ones that really do a good job, they all say, of course, we have a lot of people who go home. Why? Because you help them straighten their lives out, feel good about themselves, relationships. Then they say, you know, I'm feeling better. I'm going to go home for a while. Now, the while could be, you know, 6 months or 10 years. I've seen all those things happen. So to me, again, over and over again, it's helping people heal their lives, look at what is going on. And another that I was criticized for was saying to people, what's happened the last few years in your life? Because I found that when you developed an illness, often had to do with changes in your life. Again, this is in psychology, psychotherapy journals, and a whole host of things, what we call life crisis units.
Right.
But, you know, it's not taught to the surgeon and the oncologist. So, again, I was yelled at for blaming my patients by saying what's happened in your life. But even in poetry, see, that's the thing to me that proves it. W.H. Auden, in a poem called Miss G, wrote about cancer. A doctor comes home after examining this very lonely lady and says to his wife, you know, cancer's a funny thing. Childless women get it, and men when they retire, as if there had to be an outlet for their foiled creative fire. Now, I would scream that just because it rhymes doesn't make it true. But a study not too long ago showed loneliness affects the genes that control immune function. So, boom, you see, suddenly the poem and my experience are scientific. And those are the things that I've seen over the years. So I don't get on all the famous talk shows for people to yell at me and say, you're crazy and it doesn't, and you're blaming patients, you know, because so much is supported now. And I literally get emails and letters and calls from all over the world, people mm-hmm. saying thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, the thank you, I call myself a coach.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because if somebody says to me, you saved my life, or your book saved my life, I say, no, it didn't. You saved your
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to do is coach people in what I call survival behavior. Psychiatrist George Solomon called it an immune competent personality. And I have these things on my website, mm-hmm. Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com. So you mm-hmm. can look at these simple questions about your personality. And again, you see, what we forget is Bruno Klopfer, who's a psychologist working with cancer patients. And many years ago, he was given 24 personality profiles of cancer patients and correctly predicted 19 out of 24 times who would have a rapidly growing cancer, who would have a slow growing cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Once he said, I can't tell, and four times he was wrong. But again, that's pretty interesting, you see, to say that from a personality, we can predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that's why I started working with people, see, that whether you call it rebirthing, born again, remaking yourself, acting as if, because the AA says fake it till you make it. In other words, you're helping people to change.
Mm-hmm.
And as they change, their genes get a different message.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful poem by John Updike. A scab is a beautiful thing, a coin the body has minted with an invisible motto, in God we trust.
Mm-hmm.
Our body loves us. And then mm-hmm. it goes on. But that sentence... See, at first, the poem attracted me as a surgeon, you know, that
right.
we're capable of healing, what the mm-hmm. scab shows us. There's intelligence in the body built into it. But then our body loves us. That hit me later
mm-hmm.
because our body does not see death as the worst outcome. So you hate your life. Well, look at good old Monday morning, more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
See, your body is doing you a favor.
Right.
You know, you don't have to go to work today, or you may never have to go to work if we die today. But if your body says, ah, oh, you love life, I feel it, and you love me,
mm-hmm.
I'll do all I can for you. And that, again, the symbolism I found very interesting in terms of my thoughts, that this is not a spontaneous remission or a miracle. It's something that was induced by the person because of their lifestyle changes.
Mm-hmm.
When I was reading the book Cancer Ward years ago, Solzhenitsyn, the author, had cancer. And there in the book, it says, one of the men walks on to the ward and says, hey, look, I found this book in the medical library. It says here there are cases of self-induced healing, not recovery through treatment, but actual healing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was as though self-induced healing flooded out of the great open book like a rainbow-colored butterfly for everyone to see. When I read that, I thought, oh, that is really acknowledging and verifying my feeling.
Mm-hmm.
That it's self-induced, that the symbol is a butterfly of transformation, and the rainbow, because I do a lot of work with drawings, every color has meaning.
Mm-hmm.
The rainbow is your life in order.
Mm-hmm.
So intuitively, he felt the same thing. You want to have a case of healing, start a new life in order, and watch what your body will do for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's hard for a lot of people to do.
Right.
I compare it to the still pond. So that and that's where things like faith and meditation, peace of mind, in other words, the ugly duckling isn't screaming and yelling and resenting his mother. So he can see that he's a swan. He's got a quiet mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's still water. It's not mm-hmm. turbulent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another story of a tiger a tiger dies giving birth, and the goat she's chasing decide to raise her little tiger. And that's what I love about animals, by mm-hmm. the way. I mean, they are so filled with love. I'm laughing because somebody sent me a video of a large pig raising tigers, literally. All these little tigers are being milked, you know, and cared for by a pig. And, you know, and mm-hmm. she's not worried that they're going to have her for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But this tiger is finally seen by another tiger who says, come with me, you're not a goat. And he takes him again to a still pond and says, see, you're a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And Campbell goes on to say that the pond is like meditation. like yoga, you know, you quiet your mind and then mm-hmm. you see the truth. And that's the hard part, I think, for most of the world, to say, okay, I'll quiet my life and mind versus I need this, I want that, I'm, you know, I'm late on the all the craziness that we live with. You see, when you bring up the faith issue, I grew up with a mother who used to drive me nuts by saying, because, you know, as a kid, I mean, picture mm-hmm. coming home from school as a teenager, having had a horrendous day, and my mother say, I'd say, Mom, I had a horrible day. It was meant to be. God is redirecting you. Something good will come of this. And, I mean, I never didn't spend much time talking to my mother, because I really felt that was a great way to ignore me.
Mm-hmm.
But what I ended up doing was talking to God in my bedroom with the door shut so nobody would think I was nuts,
mm-hmm.
and noticing that often things happened, and my mother was right, you
mm-hmm.
know, that you, one thing doesn't work out, you get refused, rejected, whatever, and something else happens, and you say, oh. You know, well, the way I put it now, so people understand, you're on the way to the airport, you get a flat tire, you're cursing and screaming because you're going to miss the plane. Then you find out that the plane you missed crashed.
Right.
See?
Mm-hmm.
So I call it the spiritual flat tire. The curse becomes a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you grow up with parents who are teaching you things like that, you're programmed in a very healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
With what I call mottos to live by, not mottos to die by.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the people I take care of now who were told they're failures. I mean, even told by their parents, it's okay, fine, go commit suicide. And what those kids are like. And when do I see them? When they get a life-threatening illness and then begin to rethink their lives, you know, what I call reparent themselves and realize they are worth something
mm-hmm.
and a child of God.
Because, mm-hmm.
again, my faith issue is, how would you introduce yourself to God? And if you separate yourself from God, in other words, your profession, or I'm a mother, or God says, come back and you know who you are. But when there's no separation, when you can say to God, I am your child, I am you, God says, come on in. And that's what we really have to realize. We are divine children.
Mm-hmm.
How we're brought up, yeah, affects us greatly. And what's within us, we project on others. And the more godliness that's in you, the nicer the world seems to you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, you mentioned the exceptional cancer patients
mm.
and how they live longer than their doctors expected them.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that group and what you learned from the group?
Yeah. Some of the oncologists in town told me I was going to hurt people because I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm running group meetings. But what I learned was to keep my mouth shut
mm-hmm.
and learn from them. You know, they became my therapist. So
mm-hmm.
if somebody would do well, I'd basically say, how come you didn't die when you were supposed to? And they all had stories. And even when you look back, see, in literature, it's
mm-hmm.
action, wisdom, devotion. In other words, there are certain patterns to these people. They will take action. They will do things. They will seek knowledge. And they have that spiritual support and faith. I literally have seen a number of people who have left their troubles to God
mm-hmm.
and had their disease disappear
mm-hmm.
from AIDS to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, early on, people would say to me, I have cancer, I want you to document my healing, see, with God.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember one woman, I said to her, look, it is not easy to leave all your troubles to God, you know, to have that total peace. I
mm-hmm.
said, why don't you let me operate and let God keep you well? And she got totally angry at me. I mean, oh, she was livid that I had no faith. And she walked out of the office. I was lecturing in New York City 6 years later, and she walked up to me and said, you remember me? I said, I remember your face, but I don't remember it. And then she reminded me, because I had said to her, it's hard to be a saint. And so I hugged her and said, I'm so happy to meet a saint, because she was perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, you know, all these things are possible. And the word I use with people is potential.
Mm-hmm.
See, I love the line from Ernest Holmes, the founder of religious science.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what if Jesus was the only normal person who ever lived? I'm sure he had to be smiling when he wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
But what a wonderful, fascinating thought, you see.
Right.
What are we capable of? And that's the part that I again see people afraid of. Because,
mm-hmm.
but if I try and don't do it, I'm a failure again, like my mother and father told me I was. So That's why when you send out the letter saying, hey, come on, come to a meeting, when you say the exceptional patient, I made it a little difficult for them to join. You had to read a book. I hadn't even written any books then, so I had a list of other books. You had to draw a picture of yourself and your disease and so forth and treatment. And then you had to answer a group of questions, like what happened last year or two in your life, what does the disease mean to you, how do you benefit from illness, you know, a whole host of things. And I realized the majority of people said things like, I'm not an artist, I don't have time to read a book, maybe I can come next year. You know, they were always finding excuses because they were afraid I could do it wrong. And then I'd meet other people who would call me from out of town, and I'd say, wait a minute, before you come to the meeting, you have to read the book. And they said, oh, fine, I'll stay up tonight and do everything. See, that was survival behavior. They had the motivation, the action. And I see that today when people contact me from all over the world, or, you know, you get a phone call, they're not worrying about, is he eating dinner? Is he busy? Am I disturbing him? I want to get better.
Right.
And I always tell them, you know, the fact that you sought me out and found me says that you're special. So, or even how far people drive to the meeting. And we've seen this, one oncologist wrote about it too in Chicago. He said the people who live more than 15 miles away did 3 to 4 times as well with his new protocol as those who live near the hospital. They had to make more of an effort to get there. And another doctor, you see how the mind business, said he was part of this new protocol and 4 chemotherapy agents were given, which began with the letters E, like for etoposide, E-P-O and H. So they were giving the EPO protocol. And suddenly he realized, if you turn the letters around, it spells hope. So he started calling it the hope protocol. And he had more people respond to therapy than the other doctor. And add one more factor why I get so involved in the mind. People respond to what they think is happening. In other words, you know, we all talk about the placebo, but you say, I'm giving you chemotherapy, your hair will fall out. And you give them injection of saline and their hair falls out. And so you can induce side effects by what you say to patients, and doctors aren't trained to talk, unfortunately. And when people expect that they are being treated, what can happen? Because I know from a radiation therapist who said the machine was repaired and they didn't put the radioactive material in. And so he hasn't treated anybody for a month. And he was telling me he really felt so upset that he didn't realize this until their routine inspection. And, oh, he was going, I said, wait a minute. He said, what do you mean? I said, you don't really understand what you are saying. He said, no, I'm telling you, I feel awful. I said, look, you would have to be an idiot to not know you aren't treating anybody for a month. So it's obvious to me that people thought they were being treated and therefore had side effects and shrinking tumors. And his eyes bulged and he said, oh, my God, you're right. Yeah, that's what I've learned. So I try to induce positive effects. You know, I always say you can deceive people into healing, too, say, by what you tell them. And it amazed me that when people saw their treatment as a gift from God, you know, as definitely the right thing for them, I could do major surgery and they'd wake up with no pain. And I mean that literally. Nurses would say to me, your patients are refusing their medication. I'd say, did it ever occur to you they're not hurting? And, you know, then the nurses would say, But they began to change what they wrote in the record. Not refuses medication, but not required. And that really, I have to say, impressed me. Do major surgery, and they don't hurt. Well, it's the term I use now, it's like a labor pain. That because women who are looking forward to having a child surrounded by loved ones have far fewer complications and need for anesthesia when they give birth. And so if what you're going through is your labor pain to give birth to yourself, be it chemotherapy, radiation, taking pills, whatever, you have far fewer side effects than somebody who says, oh, I'm going through hell, this is terrible, look what they're giving me, look what I have to do.
Bernie, you talk a lot about love and laughter. And what have you seen that reinforces this?
Well, again, we've had a study. Cancer patients who laugh live longer. And you don't need, the study revealed that you don't need something funny. You just laugh several times a day. And I'd say to anybody listening to this, stop and laugh and watch how you feel in a few minutes. My wife used to do stand-up, what I call female Henny Youngman type one-liners as part of our presentation. And then the audience physically, you know, could see and feel how different they were after 10 or 15 minutes of laughter versus 2 hours of listening to Bernie Siegel. So, you know, I used it in a very physical sense to say to them, pay attention to how you feel. And then 15 minutes later, okay, how do you feel now? And they'd go, oh, yeah, how much better? So it's physiologic to laugh and to love. It changes our internal chemistry. And again, that the genes don't make decisions. See, they're affected, what's called epigenetics. They're affected by the internal chemistry. That's what turns them on and off. So somebody who's full of resentment, internalizing it, never showing their own emotions, doing what everybody else wants, is more likely to get breast cancer than her, what I call, little devil of a sister who's out there, you know, letting everybody know how she feels, saying no to them, doing what she wants, and living her unique, authentic life. So all of these things, as I say, become scientific. And what I say to people is that you need to build your life out of what I call the bricks of love. But what holds the love together is the laughter, the humor. That's the cement that holds the bricks together. And when you can have love and laughter in your life, some wonderful things happen. And I think the children and the animals display this very well because they don't worry about the future. You know, I mean, they may have a life-threatening illness, but they still focus on how can I have a nice day, not what's going to happen next year. Yeah, because statistics don't determine the future. They can help you make decisions. You know, as one woman said, my doctor said I have a 3% greater chance of surviving if I have radiation. Well, it's not worth it, she said, 3%. Okay. But if he said 30%, she'd probably say, fine, I'll show up tomorrow. So you can use the statistics to help you decide, but they don't predict the future. You know, there's a 90% chance you're going to die. Okay, but you got a 10% chance that you can survive. I always say winning the lottery is very unlikely, but it happens to some people.
Bernie, you mentioned meditation, prayer, positive outlook, and some of these things that you've talked about. Are these individual practices, or are there things that physicians and healthcare personnel can do to help the patient?
Yeah, I think you can integrate both things. What I found, especially in the operating room, was creating a healing environment, bringing music into the operating room. And literally, I was called an explosion hazard because I was bringing an electrical appliance in where there were explosive gases. But a few years ago, maybe three or four at Yale, one of the doctors did a study and showed the benefits of music in the operating room. The operations finished sooner. The amount of drugs needed to anesthetize a patient were reduced. So again, see, suddenly it's scientific. It's not crazy Siegel. But again, people, even though it wasn't scientific, everybody in the operating room felt better. And they would say, hey, I'd like to work with him because you feel better at the end of the day. Because they were hearing that music too. And I began to learn from some musicians, you know, that there's a certain beat that relaxed people, certain type, like Taco Bell's kind of became my favorite. It just relaxed everybody. And if you think of a slow heart rate, you know, like the athletes have a heart rate in their 60s, it's that kind of beat. Well, think of listening to a clock, because that also impressed me. You have 60 seconds in a minute. So when you hear the clock ticking, tick, 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 it relaxes you. But if we had 100 seconds, which seemed to me a more reasonable thing if somebody were setting up a time system, you know, why'd they pick 60? If you had 100, it would be tick, 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 and we'd all be nervous, you know, listening to it. So, again, music, the things like a mantra, you know, saying a word or a prayer, it, again, shifts your thinking so that you're not in there worrying. I often say to people now, you can't use words anymore. You can't think with words. And it's like, huh? But I found it one day that when I was thinking about things, I said, okay, no more words. Hey, then I can't worry because I can't create a worrisome dialogue. No words? Okay. My mind is clear and restful.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want a word, yeah, I can pick a word that will bring me peace.
Mm-hmm.
I started keeping at my desk now the prayer from St. Francis of Assisi that starts, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas hatred, let me so love. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you said something like that, say, right, like the word ahimsa, Mahatma Gandhi, the no violence, no harm. So you can repeat words like that and calm yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in the midst of difficulties and conflict, instead of screaming and yelling at another person, it's let me show love.
Mm-hmm.
Let me not harm the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And what a difference it makes.
Right.
All these things, again, have been studied. You know, when mm-hmm. now that we have all these scans, you can see what meditation does to the brain.
Right.
And we're talking about science, not just feeling good.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bernie, you advocate patient empowerment.
Mm.
And is that necessary for healing?
I think it's necessary for survival.
Mm-hmm.
100,000 people a year die in the hospital of medical errors.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they're nice, good patients who are submissive and don't question, don't ask, and get the wrong treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I use the word respite. You need to be a responsible participant. You need to empower yourself. You need to question doctors. And if a doctor won't accept criticism, I'd say get another doctor, because they're not going to learn from their mistakes. They're going to blame you.
Mm-hmm.
I just wrote an article the other day because there was a letter to the editor in our local paper about how this woman and her husband were basically abused by an oncologist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the things he told them, even telling them the wrong reports. The wife said, I have the report in front of me. That's not what it says. Oh, well, oh, it must have been another patient. I mean, if he doesn't say I'm sorry, then get out of there.
Right.
Because he's projecting his troubles onto you.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that we need to help doctors understand why they become doctors, so that they choose specialties for healthy reasons. So Kevorkian doesn't need to end up in jail. He can end up running a hospice
right.
instead of killing people. And, you know, if you're brought up being told you're a failure, then you can pick a specialty where you can't fix what's wrong with your patients, and they're all dying, and, you know, it just confirms, up, I'm a failure again.
Mm-hmm.
But you take it out on your patients, too.
Right.
So the patient needs to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be, you know, nasty. One woman the other day was emailing me, because I said, find out your doctor's birthday, get a humorous birthday card and deliver it. Then you'll become something special to your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Or bring a gift to the office, some flowers or a pretty picture for the wall to help relax people. And she said in her chart, he had all the cards that she has sent tucked in there.
Mm-hmm.
So every time he opens her chart, he's smiling and boom, it's two people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a doctor and a disease, it's
mm-hmm.
two people. And that's the part. People have to say, this is what I'm experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
This is the help I need from you. Not, here's my diagnosis, what pills should I take?
Mm-hmm.
We need to know what's going on. I mean, an ad in the New England Journal of Medicine read, I'm depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel, you know, fine now. I wrote the journal and the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company, and I said, look, I'm depressed because I've had a terrible problem in my family, and the doctor doesn't even say, why are you depressed? What's going on? I said, is this how you want to train doctors? Every time somebody comes in, they say, okay, here, goodbye, take
mm-hmm.
the pill.
Mm-hmm.
And so they cancel the ad. But you know, we have to really say to people, what are you going through? What are you experiencing? And treat the experience. And people need to speak up and talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, and be empowered. And that gets back to the action, wisdom, devotion. It's okay for you to look up things and ask your doctor, get second opinions, look at alternative therapies. I mean, all these things are slowly creeping into the system
mm-hmm.
and need to be a part of it.
Slowly is the word.
Oh, it's way behind what I'd like it to be. I mean, back, I think, 30 years ago, I wrote to the deans of the schools I was trained at to say, you made me a fine technician,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know how to take care of myself or my patients.
Mm-hmm.
And never did anybody write back to me. that to me is the saddest part of all.
Right, right.
You know, your own student is saying, this mm-hmm. is how I feel. And even if they wrote back saying, we received your letter, thank you. You know what I mean? A form letter.
Right.
I would have said, okay, at least I know you read what I said.
Right.
But
right.
to not even answer is just amazing.
Yeah. Well, Bernie, do you have final thoughts before we look at your books and services and help?
Well, what I hear from the medical students today, some schools are better than others, you know, mm-hmm. where they're having classes in integrative medicine and complementary and humanizing the process. And there are other students who write to me with, I'm devastated, mm-hmm. because they care about people, and they're not learning anything about people when they get to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And the one last thing I might mention is when I said I do a lot with drawings,
mm-hmm.
when you say to medical students, draw yourself working as a doctor, the majority of pictures, the drawings, have no human being in them other than the medical student sitting, you know, behind mm-hmm. a desk with a diploma over their head.
Mm-hmm.
And that part blew my mind
right.
when I first started doing this, to say, draw yourself working as a doctor. And an extremely rare picture will be of a student kneeling in front of a wheelchair, handing somebody a tissue, you know, or touching them, and not with an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
That is like, you know, 1 out of 100.
Right.
And the majority are the depersonalizing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we need to be empowered and become a person
mm-hmm.
to each other.
Yeah. Well, then, Bernie, will you tell us about your books and services and how listeners could reach you?
Yeah, the website, again, is, you know, the W's, and then Bernie Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, MD.com. And I answer. I mean, I don't have a staff. So you click on Contact Us, it's me, and I'll get back to you. And my first book was Love, Medicine, and Miracles. The latest one related to cancer is Faith, Hope, and Healing. And again, after each story, there is a reflection, because for me, that's similar to the water. That what can we learn from people and their story? As I said, there's a personality profile, so I can point out what we can learn from each person's story. And there are many other books also, including
mm-hmm.
children's books and a whole host of things.
But
if people go to the website, they're all listed. And there's another thing I keep forgetting. If you want to hear a Bernie Siegel lecture, it's on the website too, because you click on it. It's like watching it on TV on your computer, you know, the YouTube stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a whole lecture by me and the drawings and my description of them related to personal issues as well as treatment, and see all these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate this, Bernie. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And
thank
I always
you.
Learn a lot from hearing what you're doing at the present and what you've done in the past.
Yeah, I keep running support groups for 30 years because I know what makes a difference for people.
Right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Carl.
My second guest, Leslie Davenport, has unique qualifications in the body-mind-spirit field. San Francisco Chronicle dance critic Ellen Ulrich reviewed Leslie as a professional dancer endowed with a superior sense of balance and power of communication that set her aside from the herd. As a psychotherapist in practice for 20 years, she understands the impact of thoughts and emotions and has a passion for mystery of the human spirit, which drew her to become an ordained interfaith minister in 1984. Leslie has braided her expertise with body, mind, spirit into her book, Healing and Transformation Through Self-Guided Imagery, released by Celestial Arts / Random House. She is a founding member for the Institute of Health and Healing at California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, which brings holistic care into the heart of conventional medicine. Leslie teaches in the Integrative Medicine Program. Her book and expert advice have appeared in a number of magazines, including Family Circle, Natural Health, Great Health, Body and Spirit, Shift, and San Francisco Medicine. She lectures in a broad range of settings that include KRON Television, the National Wellness Conference, and the Commonwealth Club, to name a few. More information is available at www.lesliedavenport.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Leslie, and I look forward to hearing how you use imagery and faith for healing. First, guided imagery is commonly associated with mind-body medicine, and yet you relate it to a spiritual dimension. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Well, any kind of guided imagery, and of course there are many styles and approaches, they're ultimately based on awareness, so that we're heightening our sensitivity to sensing, perceiving a form of knowing that's very direct and immediate, much more so than our logical mind provides. And this type of imagery, primarily within the health field and the medical field, has encouraged us to use this awareness with our bodies, and then to invite images or either install images with a healing purpose. And while this is very helpful and there's a lot of good research that documents the benefits of this, if from my point of view, it's just not complete because it's not really using all of who we are. So what I like to add is also being able to turn that same light of awareness to our essence, our core self. It could be called the spirit dwelling within us. You know, there's all kinds of words and beliefs that would name it differently, but the notion is that it goes to additional, deeper layers of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the way you work, is guided imagery the same as visualization?
I love being able to address this question because it's one of my little shifts that I advocate for in how we talk about imagery, because those terms are often used synonymously, mm-hmm. They're interchanged, but I like to draw a distinction because just in the same way in our external world with our body, we have multiple senses. We can see the environment with our eyes, we can listen for the sounds, we can take note of the scents and so forth. The same is true with our internal organs of perception. And I think the reason that they've gotten linked together is that it's about 60% of people, so it's the slight majority that tends to have their inner sight as the most predominant sense, but it's not the only one. A lot of people, when they're quieting their mind and turning inward and listening for a different type of wisdom, get a kind of insight where they might hear a phrase or they just sense an impression or there's a different kind of knowing. And it may or may not be accompanied by a visual image, but it doesn't in any way diminish the impact or the value of it, whether or not it's accompanied by a visual component. And a reason that I think this is so important is I run into people who say, well, you know, I've tried imagery at a workshop, but I just can't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I often have to educate them through an experience that maybe that's just not their way
mm-hmm.
of tapping into their rich inner world of images.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that they can't do it, because it really is utilizing a very natural capacity
mm-hmm.
that we all came with as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Now, Leslie, can you tell us about a patient you've worked with who drew upon their faith using this approach to healing?
Yes. You know, I'm going to give kind of an overview and then talk about someone specifically. A lot of people use imagery when they're drawing on their spiritual aspect or their faith tradition, and can come into contact with what we might think of in more traditional ways as a spiritual guide or advisor. It could be an angelic figure. It could be a well-known religious figure like Jesus. For some people who have a more indigenous leaning, it might be even an animal totem. But I want to give a specific example of one that's sort of unexpected, because there, again, there's a lot of people that I work with anyway who may not have a religious tradition they follow, and yet they feel deeply spiritual, and they have to sort of discover for themselves what that looks like or what that feels like for them at this time in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a young woman named Juliet who I worked with. She was about to enter a 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and because of that program, she was wanting to come in touch with a higher power, but really felt kind of lost with that. She was raised Catholic, but didn't relate to that anymore, and she didn't find a draw towards the more Eastern meditative side of things. So I led her through a guided imagery experience, and the image that arose for her as her higher power was a broken bowl that had been pieced back together.
Mm-hmm.
And as we talked about it, because it didn't even really make sense to her initially of what this image was or was about, it struck her that this bowl represented a bowl of her parents that she had accidentally broken one day several years ago when she had been drinking, and tried to hide it in her shame by kind of gluing it back together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as she dialogued with this image, this bowl said to her, "You are whole even with the cracks,
mm-hmm.
maybe even because of the cracks."
Mm-hmm.
And it gave for her a very kind of realistic way to embrace her deeper sense of wholeness in spite of what she was struggling with, in spite of the recovery path she was on. And I love that image because it just reminds us that it can take any form. It's kind of, imagery is sort of like dream images in the sense that we don't have to take the specifics literally, but
mm-hmm.
what's the message? What's the feeling? What does it help us get in touch with regardless of what form it takes?
Mm-hmm.
And so for her, this was a sense of a message of, you are whole, and there is a place that you can tune into and feel that again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it that the symbols then are somewhat specific to the individual? Because, for example, if I dream about hospital, being a nurse, that may relate to my work. Whereas if someone else dreamed about hospital, that might relate to an illness.
Yes, exactly. There's two things. Our images are very specific to our constitution, our history, our inclinations, our gifts and talents,
mm-hmm.
our experiences. And so they do come in a form that has special meaning and familiarity to us.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I've noticed, and Jung certainly wrote a lot about this, that there tend to be certain universal or sort of archetypal images
mm-hmm.
that as human beings that we can often tap into as well.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe we didn't have a direct experience of something, and yet some part of us still has access to this collective level of human consciousness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I interviewed a woman that wrote a book. She wrote 8 books on dreams, and one of them was on the universal symbols, and that was very interesting to look at because we've all had those dreams, the dreams of falling,
yeah.
the dreams of being chased.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what some of the other ones were, but they were symbols that most of us have experienced at one time or another in our dreams.
Yes. Yes. And while I do find, you know, there's things like dream dictionaries or imagery dictionaries, I think it can be interesting to look at those, but
mm-hmm.
I think ultimately we have to have some kind of little light or something
right.
go off inside us that says,
mm-hmm.
oh, yes, that feels mm-hmm. true for me.
Right, right. Now, Leslie,
yeah.
how would someone get started if they wanted to explore this type of healing practice themselves?
You know, I've been involved with imagery work in a professional context for about 20 years, and I'm really trying to find all kinds of ways
mm-hmm.
to make this easily available to people. So one of the things I've done is I have a web page, which is my name. It's LeslieDavenport.com. And on there, I've included about 6 free MP3s where people can either download them or just click and play it through their computer. And there's one in particular called Journey to the Wisdom of Your Heart that guides you along a structure of how to turn inward, to move away from the chatter in our mind, to move toward these deeper levels of ourselves and invite a wise image to appear, again, knowing it might come in any form, and then how to initiate a dialogue. So I invite people to give that a try because it's simple and easy. It takes about 20 minutes. And someone can bring any kind of a life concern to that practice. It can be health-related. It could be a decision that needs to be made, and all the pros and cons have already been written out, but now someone needs to get an intuitive sense of what's right. So that's a great way. And there's lots of resources on there, including some articles, and I put out a quarterly newsletter that points to some imagery research and other tips and things like that, too.
Have you pretty much then covered the resources, or are there others that the listener might turn to?
Well, let me mention also my book, which came out last year. It's called Healing and Transformation Through Self-Guided Imagery. It's published by Random House and available on Amazon and a number of places. And I'm mentioning that because while the MP3 gives you the essence of how to turn inward, sometimes we do bump into common obstacles, like what if no image does appear, or what if somebody gets three, or what if there's an image but it seems scary instead of wise. So I've used the format of the book to take it even more as a more full exploration of how to work with whatever experience arises.
Now, are there other services or products that you would like to mention, and also your website?
Yeah, so again, my website is my name, Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, Davenport, all one word, .com. And on there are links to a lot of other resources. I have an events page myself where I do a lot of speaking workshops. I'm teaching a couple of how to facilitate guided imagery towards others. That's a great resource for health professionals. That's going to be through John F. Kennedy University. But also other organizations. The Academy for Guided Imagery is another wonderful resource. They do trainings, but they've also listed internationally all the people they have trained. So pretty much wherever you live, you could see if you wanted to work with someone in addition to pursuing this on your own. It tells you how to get in touch with a practitioner in your area. So that's where I've tried to consolidate the resources that are out there.
Do you have any final words for the listeners?
Yes, let me just point to the tremendous healing potential that's available within. And let me offer this image. You know, when we're moving through our daily life and we're focusing on our external environment, most of the time we're just kind of navigating through our house or our office or across town or sometimes across the country. But if we were to stop and pause and look up, we can experience that actually we're in a much vaster place. We're in the midst of galaxies and a huge, mysterious, and elegant universe. And the same thing is true when we focus inward. You know, most of the time we're just engaged with a few conscious thoughts that help us navigate. But if we pause and we turn inward and we reflect, there's a huge, powerful, deep resources within, including resources for healing. Much of it is mysterious and uncharted, but there are ways to navigate, and it's practical as well as mysterious. So just an invitation.
That's nice, Leslie, and we need to make time to do that more often.
Yes, it is a practice.
Right. Well, I thank you very much, Leslie. This has been interesting, and I know it will be helpful to the listeners.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the great resources you're providing.
Thank you.